Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. I am with a woman who means so much to our Mito community. I've really enjoyed getting to know her and learning about her family's journey. Her name is JB McGee, and she has so much to offer us. And I can't wait to introduce you to her so that she can tell her story, the story of her and her family. So welcome, JB.
Hi.
Hi. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah. I'm excited about this.
Good. So let's kick it off and just kind of talk about the journey of getting you and your sons diagnosed. I know it happened in a really backward way, and I'm sure it's going to resonate with others in our Mito community. I know it resonates with myself as well. Please take us through that.
Okay. So we have our first son, Noah, who came out with a lot of medical issues, but they were really brushed off as, oh, it's just a cold, oh, it's just a virus, until about 6 months old when he got, we noticed that he wasn't breathing. And, you know, then we were told it was apnea, and I was like, but he's awake. He's awake and not breathing.
So you would notice he was awake and not breathing.
Yeah, we would notice it.
And he would start back up again?
Yeah. Yeah. And the nurses, we would get him to the hospital, of course, but, you know, he wouldn't perform. He would be, like, all happy, flirting with the nurses. And they were like, this kid's fine. This kid, he's so cute. He's completely fine. So I finally asked for a sleep study, and that sleep study proved that he did have significant sleep apnea. So thank goodness for the ENT. I mean, the moment I walked in the door, the ENT was the first person to really believe me. As a new mom, I think at this point, you know, like I said, we were around 6 months old, and I had just been gaslit the whole time of Noah's life at that point, short life, but still. And he was like, oh, this is reflux. I deal with this all the time. This kid has uncontrolled reflux. I know exactly what this is. He's probably got uncontrolled apnea, probably uncontrolled reflux. I don't know why they won't put these kids on reflux meds. And so we started down that journey, and sure enough, it was reflux, but it took us to seeing, like, I ended up having to go to multiple doctors. We ended up going to this doctor that was about an hour away from us that I met because I met them, a mom on a message board that told me to go see this doctor. She was like, it is reflux, but it's a special kind of reflux that's not going to go away, and it's life-threatening, and you're going to end up losing your kid if you don't get a grip on it, and you need to go see this doctor. And so I did. And he admitted us the first time he ever saw us. I took 50 questions, 2 pages worth, I think, of questions to him. And he just, you know, he went through all of them. He read all of his chart, and he was like, you're just so lost in the sea of specialists. That's a word that stuck with me, is being lost in the sea of specialists. You're so lost in the sea of specialists. I'd like to admit you and see if we can run a bunch of tests and see if we can figure things out of what's going on here and get a better idea of what we can do for y'all. So that's what we ended up doing. And we ended up being there for 2 weeks. Noah had a G-tube put in and a Nissen fund application, which is where they wrap the top of your stomach around the bottom of your esophagus. And that's supposed to stop reflux. But there's a test that they do before they do that, that usually you want to be negative because this surgery can actually have a lot of complications if it's not. And we had already done the test, and we had gotten a negative. But I had said to them over and over that I thought they were doing the test wrong, that he needed to be off of his reflux meds, and they had for a longer period of time, and they had said, no, he didn't need to be. And it turned out that he did. So we did this surgery, and Noah lost the ability to vomit because you can't vomit anymore afterwards. I mean, Noah's 19 years old now, and he still can't vomit. And he can burp, but he can't vomit. And he's never vomited since he got the Nissen fund application. Well, maybe a couple of times he's vomited past it, like when he was really, really sick. But in general, he does not. And so we ended up with this kid who we had taken away his ability to vomit, but we'd also didn't realize that the bottom of his system, his gut, his lower gut, his lower GI system was so slow that he couldn't get his bowels out, you know, his bowel movements out either. So stuff was just stuck and backing up, and he was dealing with massive constipation then. And then, you know, he would be retching, and he would get, he actually didn't retch a whole lot, but he would cry and say, "My boo-boo hurts, my boo-boo hurts." That's what he called it, was his boo-boo. And we would open the tube and we would vent out everything that he'd eaten for the last several hours, and it would just come gushing out with a bunch of gastric juice and stuff. And we called those residuals. And Noah just always had really high residuals. But everybody kind of, again, gaslit and made excuses for why that was happening. And I want to fast forward because I could spend a lot of time on Noah. But basically, they told us they had ruled out genetic issues for us. I found out I was pregnant about a week after we came home from the hospital with him. Surprise! We had no idea, and we had not been trying. And looking back, it was a huge blessing. And it, you know, if it had not happened right at that time, it would have never happened. We would have never done it. So it was perfect timing. But I found out I was pregnant, and I was so scared that the second baby was going to have the same thing going on with Noah, but everybody was assuring me that it was not genetic and everything was going to be fine. But then this baby comes out, and this baby is exactly like Noah, if not worse than Noah. And by this time I have a doctor who believes me, who's like, you know, understanding. Jonah went on an apnea monitor, I think at a week old. and you know, went on reflux meds after about a week or two old. As soon as he was old enough to go on reflux meds, Jonah was on reflux meds. And in and out of the hospital and having tests run. And everybody was so leery to do the Nissen fund application on him because of what had happened with Noah. So everybody was scared to do that. But we ended up, he had apnea also. We ended up with the sleep medicine and GI doctor in Greenville. And they were both like, this is mitochondrial disease. what are you taught? Like, why are they not looking at this?
And heard of mitochondrial disease before that?
Yes, because they had said to me one time, my pediatrician had said, listen, I'm going to rule this out. Do not look it up. It is scary. Kids die from this. Like, they don't make it out of their teenage years. They end up in wheelchairs. They have seizures. Like, they get really, really sick. Don't look it up, Brandy. Do not look it up. Of course I went home and looked it up. That was actually, I wasn't going home. We were going to the PICU. But as soon as I got to the PICU, I looked it up.
and then so were you really scared then when the doctors did say,
oh my gosh, I was terrified.
That had to be frightening. Yeah.
Because I read the list of symptoms and was like, this is my kid. And I just knew, that that's what it was going to be. And then they were like, oh, guess what? It's not. Yay. And you know that feeling when you're like, that's it. That's not right. And you're supposed to be excited about it. They expect you to be excited about it.
About getting a diagnosis?
About not getting a diagnosis.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, about like, hey, look, your kid doesn't have this horrible, terrible disease. You should be happy about that. Why are you not jumping up and down celebrating? Because in your gut, you know. You just know when you see something. Like, you know something's wrong. You know they haven't figured it out. You see this disease. You see it fully fits your child. And you And then they're telling you he doesn't have it. And you're like, how can that be? There has to be a mistake because this fits him perfectly. And we had multiple doctors say that they had ruled it out. But these two doctors were just like, has he had a muscle biopsy? And I was like, no. And they were like, we all haven't ruled it out yet. We're going to send you to a doctor in Atlanta and you're going to really rule it out. And you're not going to rule it out because they have it.
Oh, my God.
And he was like, just prepare yourself. I was like, okay. And at that point, it was a bittersweet feeling. I was like partly excited and partly terrified, you know, excited for the answer because mm-hmm. the boys were not doing well, but also terrified because nobody wants that to be the fate of their child. And nobody believed me when I would tell them what the statistics were and I would tell them how bad this disease was. Nobody acted like it was a big deal. Nobody acted like I should be as alarmed as I was or as scared as I was. They acted like I was being, and this is going to segue us into another part of your podcast, and like naturally, if you want to go there, we can go there. And I haven't even answered how we got diagnosed, but that's basically it. These two doctors sent us to this doctor in Atlanta, and this doctor in Atlanta was like, yes, they do have mitochondrial disease. And then what ended up happening was they test the parents after you find out that the kids have it. And it turned out that I got tested first because I'm the mom and I had it. And then my husband's doctor sent him because he was having all kinds of crazy symptoms. And his doctor had looked it up and was like, I think you might have what your kids have, man. I think you should go see their doctor. And he did. And sure enough, Chad has it too. And so we double whammied those babies with mitochondrial disease. And that is really rare.
Wow.
So you want to talk about people really not believing you then is like when you say, well, we all have it. And they're like, you just must have looked that up on Google and are telling yourself that because there's no way that y'all all have that. That's just like statistically not possible and just doesn't happen. And he's the dad. And how would he, you know, it just doesn't happen.
Do you think your husband and you would ever have been diagnosed without, if let's say you never had kids?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I had so many health problems going on. And I was being gaslit and I was being, you know, tossed around and kind of going through what Noah was going through. I'd been sick since I was a baby. I was gaslit as a baby. They told my mom when I was turning blue and vomiting, projectile vomiting and failure to thrive that I was just crying for attention at like 9 months old. And to just start maybe not 9 months old. It was a really young age because maybe it was 2 months old because they just told her, oh, just start feeding her solids and she'll feel better. And I was like, you started feeding me solids when?
Oh my goodness. You
know? Nobody seemed, you know, in 1980, you were allowed to smoke in the hospital.
Right.
Nobody was even thinking about, I mean, really, when you look back at when mitochondrial disease started even becoming a thing or when they even started realizing that the mitochondria had a disease impact, it was like around 1980. Mm-hmm. Like there was no awareness when I was born. And certainly
it feels like there's
up,
no awareness it's, today.
It's true. This is true.
We're working on it day by day.
I know. So, you know, once we got our diagnosis, I thought that it would be validating. I thought that everybody would understand and that it would be like that people would do awareness fundraisers for us and people would wear little bracelets for us and that people would make donations when we were financially being bankrupt because of all the medical bills. And it was horrible. It was the opposite. We had betrayals by some of our medical staff that our doctors were all like incredible, all on our team, but by like we had some nurses that had come in to help us because Noah at this age, about 4 or 5 years old, was behaviorally just a handful. And that's putting it mildly. And Jonah was also just, they were very violent when they got tired. And nobody understood that it was the fatigue that was making them tired. So they would go and they would treat them like regular kids and wear them out and then bring them back to me. And then they would try to kill me. you know, they would try to strangle me. They would bite me. They would kick me in the throat. They would kick me in the back. And we would make videos of this to try to show people. And it just made people even more suspicious because they were like, well, they were fine for us. Why are they not fine for you? Why are they behaving like this for you? Well, because all kids behave worse for their parents.
Right, right. But their problems were so compounded, so complex.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
No one was giving credit to that.
Right. And so we found out that the nursing agency that was in our house, they were supposed to be keeping a book in the house that was available to me at any time. And I was supposed to sign off on the sheets of what they were doing during the day and what had happened. And, you know, like that I had agreed with what had happened. And I found out that there was a separate book that they were keeping where they were writing notes that were the complete opposite of what had happened and not having me sign them. And they were using those to call CPS and the police department and all of our doctors to try to have our children taken away from us. And the way I found this out was, it's like something in a movie, was one day I called into our psychiatrist's office. And that's one of the protected places where they will not talk to anybody other than the parent, like unless you've signed a release. And do not sign a release to have your psychiatrist talk to anybody else other than you for your kids. That's what I would just say as some advice right there. Keep that a sacred place for you and your family. Because what happened was I called and I can't remember what I was calling about, but the girl who answered the phone was like, listen, I could lose my job for this. I'm going to be really quick, but get those nurses out of your house. They're trying to have your kids taken away. They're not there for you. They're not there to help you. They're there to hurt you. Get them out of the house. And she was like, they call here every day, Brandy. And I'm like, what? And she's like, I can't say anymore. Just get them out. And hung up. And I just was left reeling. And then, of course, you know, I start thinking, well, how do I do this without looking guilty? how do I just get them out of my house?
You stop allowing them in your home, then yeah, it gives the facade of like maybe something
to hide.
Right, exactly. So it's really a no-win situation.
Yeah, and you know, I really needed help.
For
I really
sure,
needed the nurses. They were a handful, and the kids were also in school, and I would notice that the nurses would stay back after the IEP meetings, and they would tell me that they were there to talk about other students, but I'm not stupid. I went to school to be a teacher. I have an education degree. I know how this works. Like, I know when you're lying to me and when you're when you're not lying. I wasn't born yesterday.
Well, and you understand the process of what happens.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
in the school setting.
I might have been there to talk about somebody else, but the likelihood that you had another patient at that school that you were talking to is just really, like, I just didn't buy it. So, anyway, the next time I went to their office, I started taking my husband with me to all the appointments and especially to this one. And when we went to go leave, this girl came out to the car and was like, hey, wait. And I was like, what? And she came over and she opened my jacket and opened her jacket. And I'm telling you, it's like a movie. And slid in an envelope full of all of the records that she had been keeping, that they had been sending all of these dual notes that they were sending that were not like the ones that were in my house, all the lies that they were sending and all the messages they were leaving and the begging of them to make the kids go back to school full time because they needed to be out of my house and begging this doctor to call CPS also. And all of my doctors, one day I was in the pediatrician's office and they had left the file. They would just leave the file like on his desk while we waited for him to come in. And I was just thumbing through it because I was really close to my pediatrician. He wouldn't have cared that I was doing that, even if he came in and had seen me, I don't think. But maybe at that time he would have, because things were so just tense and scary for everybody involved. But I was just thumbing through and I just saw message after message after message from them on, you know, message notes. And saying, you know, they want you to call CPS, they want you to do this. And him saying, noting in the side saying, they're a mandatory reporter, they can call CPS. And if I have concerns, I will do the same. At this time, I do not. And that was what basically both of the doctors had written in their notes. And we're telling them. And my psychiatrist was not telling them anything. My psychiatrist was saying, we don't have a release to talk to you, and we cannot confirm or deny that we have a patient by that name. And it was fabulous. And they knew that what they did because they'd been there with us, you know. They were just like, no, we're not giving you anything. We're not going there at all.
So what do you think the root of their... Of these notes, what do you think? It's just not understanding mitochondrial disease. Do you think there's that played a big part in it, and them thinking that there wasn't really something there?
I think they thought that I was nobody. From my understanding, nobody thought that I was making my children sick. They thought that I was being hypervigilant and taking them to the doctor all the time and getting all these services for them. And having all this medicalization, they had CPAPs and feeding tubes. And well, Jonah didn't have a feeding tube at that time, but Noah did. And like I can put those in. Like I can go to the doctor and just be like, "Can I have a feeding tube? Can we put this in real quick?" You know, like it's not that simple,
right?
Do I have the power to go to a doctor and be like, hey, I'm begging you, please put a feeding tube in my kid? And this doctor be like, yeah, you know, I think that would be awesome, even though he doesn't need it.
That's a really good point. So where do they, like, why would they think that?
This is what I think, though. And I told you this before the show. I wanted to bring this up. Munchausen's by proxy is a buzzword right now in the community because of or in the world because of Gypsy Rose Blanchard and her experience with her mother, which was a true case of Munchausen's by proxy. But that is the incidence per rate of Munchausen's by proxy, which, by the way, some argue Munchausen's by proxy isn't even a thing, that it's not a real syndrome, and that like it's just not, like, I can't verbalize it, but if you research it, you'll see what I'm talking about. But
the term has gotten to be very broad because of the show and the documentary and, you know, all the the podcast and different content.
There are a lot of people who have this.
It makes it seem
awareness about this. So we need to be on the lookout for people who may have this. The likelihood that somebody has that versus the likelihood that they have mitochondrial disease is flipped. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more rare to have Munchausen's by proxy than it is to have mitochondrial disease.
Mm-hmm. Or another rare disease that is very, where there's not that much awareness about it. I mean, there's other rare disease communities.
Yes. People with EDS are constantly being split and through the same thing. So this is the first time that I've publicly spoken out about it. It's been, I have see PTSD from this. This is something that I have a lot of trauma from, because it didn't just happen once. I don't have enough time on this podcast to tell you the many times that this came up, and it was always an ignorant person. And I don't want to say stupid, because stupid is like lacking the knowledge. Ignorant is like knowing the knowledge and still like ignoring it, ignoring that knowledge, and just doing it anyway. And it was like we had people who should have known better that we weren't doing this to our children, who were being told by multiple doctors that we weren't doing this to our children. And they were one-man shows trying to lead a crusade. And they always lost, but it didn't do any less trauma. I will say the last time that it happened, I finally stood up for myself. The kids were a little older, so I felt a little braver. Although now with the Justina Pelletier case that happened at Boston Children, she was 15. I don't feel as brave as I did then, because it shows that they'll take them at any age, apparently. But if you don't know that case, you can look it up. But she was a 15-year-old girl who went to Boston Children's Hospital because that's where her GI had moved to. He had previously been at Tufts, and the ER department took her away from her parents. She went in as an award-winning figure skater and has come out as a paralyzed child and or now an adult. And they ruined her life, basically. Or at least ruined her, you know, mobility. And I can't imagine the trauma they did to her. They were treating her with psychotropic drugs, even though she didn't have those conditions. And they were putting her through trials, even though she didn't have those conditions. And it was just a very bad situation. But back to what I was saying is, the last time I stood up for myself, I was like, this is not okay. It was the same doctor who had done it previously to my younger son and had gone unfounded. And he was doing it with my older son. And this had been years had passed. And it was a GI doctor who just did not understand what was going on with my kids. And he was friends with our GI doctor. And our GI doctor would like call and talk to him about them. But then he would just act different and do different things when they would hang up. And I went and got an advocate. There was, when he came in to talk to me, there was not a pastor, but a chaplain. A chaplain was in the room with me, and she stayed in the room the whole time that he talked to me. And when he left, she was like, "What just happened?" And I burst into tears. And she was like, "That was not okay. Like, what in the world is happening here?" And she's like, there's got to be a history, and this is not okay, like what he just did to you. I hope you're going to report that. And she's like, let me hook you up with an advocate. And I said, I'm scared to be hooked up with an advocate. Like, he has all the power. And she's like, no. Let's try it and see. And I started thinking about it, and I started thinking about, well, what does a bully do when you're being bullied? Like, the bully keeps on until you actually stand up for yourself. And when you finally stand up for yourself, the bully backs off. Now, in the Pelletier case, the parents tried to stand up for themselves, and they still took their kids away and almost lost her kid and almost lost her indefinitely. So I'm not saying that this would work in every situation, but in mine, it worked. I got an advocate. I went in there and I told him, look, this is what he did the first time, and you can look at the records. And he cost our kid two surgeries instead of one. Like, he was supposed to have surgeries combined, and this doctor had refused to do it that way. And it had caused Jonah to end up needing to go under the knife twice instead of once. And I was like, you know, now he's trying to call shots that are not in the best interest of Noah. And he's not a part of our team. And I don't want him a part of our team. And I, you know, would like for this to end, please, at some point. I would like for him to quit harassing my family medically. And they were like, well, we can't say or do anything. We need to have a formal meeting between everybody. you know, when can you do that? And I was like, oh, anytime, because I'm here. I was impatient. And they were like, okay, well, we'll get it set up and then we'll go from there. Well, that afternoon we were discharged and we never heard another thing about it. They just let us go home. And nobody called to set up the meeting. Nobody ever mentioned it ever again, ever again. And then when we went back to the hospital in the future, if Jonah needed a GI, I just made sure that I was like, I do not want anyone from that practice, please. And if you need to, if Jonah needs GI care and that's the only option, then we need to transfer hospitals to our GI doctor. And they were like, no, we have another GI team. So they brought in another GI and we had no problems at that point ever again.
It's so tough too, because you're, you know, a rather new mom, and you're being a new mom of any kid, typical, any type of health condition, regardless, it's so difficult in so many ways, in all ways. And to add to your, you know, mental space of not being believed has to be, like you said, so traumatic. And
it stays with you.
Oh,
it doesn't go away.
No.
So every time you go into an appointment, you're wondering,
yeah,
is this person judging me? Does this person think I'm crazy?
Will they believe my symptoms?
Yeah. Is this person that takes my child away and further traumatizes my child? You know, it just never ends. And I don't know that there's enough therapy in the world to heal me from it.
Right. I'm so sorry that this happened to you.
I want to go back to all of them. Mm-hmm. And I want to just say, like, look at what you did. Look at the harm that you did. Mm-hmm. You took oaths to first do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And look at all the harm you did. But I don't think it would make a difference.
So what advice would you have if for another family? I unfortunately, I know you're not the only ones, even in the mitochondrial community, that have struggled in this way.
No.
So what kind of advice would you give to a family to get an attorney really early on? Or, you know, what would you advise?
If you can afford an attorney and you've been backed into a corner and you have somebody that's trying to do that to you, then yes, I think certainly getting legal help as early as possible would be best thing to do, probably. But at the same time, you want to de-escalate the situation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to escalate it. You don't want to do anything that's going to ratchet up those emotions and make them pull more power. It's a tug of war, and they have one side of the rope and you have the other, and you don't want to get into a battle of them mm-hmm. trying to topple you over.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of at their mercy a little bit to kind of do what they want you to do. And you have to tread really lightly and carefully. And I think that's what we did, was we found out what our options were, how to get people out of our house. You know, if the kids needed nursing, do we replace the nursing? Like, could we get them out of the house easily? What was the method in doing that? It was easy. I just called and fired them and said, we no longer need your services anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having a good support network as well, because, you know, like I said, I had friends who'd been through this, and you know, there are going to be people out there who have experienced this that you can talk to, who gave me advice and were like, hey, do this or hey, do that. And I just think some prayer tossed in there as well, I guess, because I really think we got lucky, but I think that we also got blessed that things didn't escalate more than what they did.
Mm. It's so scary.
It is. It is. And I don't know why it kept happening to us. I would say, you know, is it, maybe it is me. Maybe there is something that's with me. Maybe I am flawed or messed up because it keeps happening. They keep doing this to me. And
it's probably so easy to think in that vein, but I mean, you all have tested positive for this rare disease. It's not you.
Yeah. And it's like you gaslight yourself almost.
Right. You right. Know? Yeah. It makes you second guess yourself for sure. For sure. Huh. Well, let's move on to a really positive topic. You've done some really incredible work. So you've published on your own. And you've also embarked on a really cool project with your son. So will you tell us about all of that?
Okay. So we were financially, medically bankrupted pretty much. Well, we were so poor, we couldn't even file for a bankruptcy. and it was around the time of 50 Shades of Grey, about 2012. And I was just in a really, really low place and very bored, felt like I needed a purpose and really wanted something to do with my life. Not that taking care of my kids wasn't a lot, but I needed something for me, you know? And I have always been creative and always needed a creative outlet. So I was reading a lot of books and had like my love of reading reignited, you could say. And one day I just had this story pop into my head and I was like, wonder if I could write a book myself. Like all these girls have done it. Like maybe I can do it. You know, these were just ordinary girls one day who decided to write a story and publish it on Amazon. And who's to say that I couldn't do that? And I think I could make some decent money doing it and make a difference for us. So I did. I sat down to my computer and started writing it and didn't tell anybody about it for a little bit. And by the time that I told them about it, I was about halfway done with it, and I finished it in 2 weeks.
Oh my gosh!
I probably should not have finished it in 2 weeks. It's not very good. But it's my first book, and, you know, they're never really very good, I guess. But I did, and... You know, I went to my dad and had to borrow money to get a cover design and had to borrow money to do the formatting to get it to where I could put it on Amazon. And so my dad loaned me some money. Actually, he didn't really loan it to me. He told me I could have it. And he was like, do you want me money too? Like, he was so sweet. But, you know, it was about $200. And I told him that I felt like that I had read an article that if you sold a copy to all your friends and family, that you could probably make about $200. And I felt like I could pay him back. And he was like, well, I sure hope you can sell more than that. And I was like, well, I don't know. That's what the article said. Well, I sold more than that within like the first week. And
that's incredible.
Yeah.
So how many books have you published in that series?
That series is Broken, Mending, Conspiring, Forgiven, and Forever. So there's five in that series. And then there's another series that I have that are like little novellas, but I published it also as like a standalone where you can just read the whole thing from start to finish, called the Magnolia Grove series. I really like that one. I feel like it doesn't get the credit it deserves. One of my most popular is Skipping Stones. It's actually a clean read. Most of my reads are a bit
clean read,
clean plus. But this one is close and near to dear to my heart. It's about my grandparents, kind of inspired by them and my relationship that I had with them. And so I published that one in 2013. It did really well. And then I have another standalone called Out of the Storm, which is really, really spicy. And then I have the one that I wrote with Noah, I guess.
So tell us about that.
I think it's about 12 or 13 books total that I've written.
I want our community to hear about this book. And I think that you're going to see an increase of sales in the next couple weeks after this airs.
So one day, Noah kept asking me if he could play a sport. This was back years ago, when he was maybe in middle school. He kept saying that he wanted to play a sport, and why couldn't he play a sport? And we would, you know, explain why he couldn't play sports, because he was partially wheelchair bound at the time. And, you know, he was on oxygen still and just having a lot of like fatigue issues, and his legs getting tired, and he wilts like a flower as soon as he walks outside from temperature dysregulation, even now. And he was just really so upset that there were no sports that he could play. And so one day I felt so hopeless, and to like keep telling him no, that there was nothing he could play. And one day I was like, would you like to write a book about this? Like, sometimes it helps to write it out and like get it out there. And I realized that that was what I was doing. I was taking my circumstances, trauma that I had in my life, and kind of flipping it in my books and making it into something that I liked. And so I kind of asked him if he wanted to do the same thing, and he did. And so we got home and he was like, can we do it now? So we sat down at the computer and we hashed it out and wrote it in one sitting, basically. And he, I don't want to give too much away. There's just this one part that I think so many people with MITO kids will resonate with. You know, Noah's legs just always get so tired, or used to get so tired when we were out and about. And I'd said, the whole point is that Matthew has mitochondrial disease. Matthew wants to play sports. Matthew is Noah. He watches his friends playing sports and he can't play. And he's, you know, he's wanting to do that. And then his parents are trying to give him all the things that they can give him to make up for the fact that he can't play sports. You know, Wii's, PlayStations, Nintendo's, all the game consoles, which we, you know, currently own all of them, from doing that ourselves, buying them all the newest games, just spoiling him rotten. And the mom decides to try to sit down and figure out like what sport that he could play. And it's just basically kind of like what we did. The book is what we did, the conversation we had, and how this kind of played out. But what he said was that blew me away was, I said, what about swimming? Swimming is so good for MITO patients, like mm-hmm. so good for like PT and all this stuff. And Noah was like, no, Matthew would never want to swim. And he'd always been afraid of the water, but I didn't know why. And I said, well, why not? Like, it's really good therapy, Noah. It would really help your legs. Like, and it wouldn't be hard. Like, you wouldn't feel like you were in therapy. And he was like, no, Matthew would be afraid that his legs would get tired and he would drown. And it just broke my heart. It just, poof, shattered, fell into a million pieces. It was so heartbreaking. And I didn't really know what to do with it. But one of my editors, after reading the book, was like, listen, you missed an opportunity here. You got to tell Matthew that there's a way for him not to drown if he gets in the water. And so why don't you teach Matthew how to float on his back? And so Matthew and Noah both know how to float on their backs now, and they're little fishes. And I'm not going to tell you the sport that he ended up finding that he could play, but he does end up finding a sport that he can play. And, you know, he ends up with a little happy ending. And Noah ended up being on an honorary member of a soccer team for a little bit through Team Impact. And they're an organization that works with special needs kids, placing them with like collegiate sports teams so that they can have an experience on like a sports team. I really highly recommend them. If you don't already know about them, check them out and see if you can get your kid involved with them.
Yeah, that could be a really great opportunity.
Yeah, my boys loved it so much. But yeah, so that's what ended up happening. And then we know it was actually with Team Impact when we were writing the book. So when they did his, you know, when they signed him onto the team, they were like, oh, he's already a published author. And he loved that so much. Aww. And then, you know, and then we had done like a blog article for Mito Action as well when they found out that we wrote the book, and we were in the newspaper a couple of times for it. So he's gotten some attention that way. But it also, you know, we took it a little bit farther. The way you found us was that you found a letter that we wrote to Congress begging them not to cut off PBS for kids. And, you know, Noah got kind of vocal there for a little bit and used his voice for good and was kind of into writing with me. And now he's not so much into writing with me anymore. He's 19 years old.
Oh, those teenagers.
He plays guitar. He's actually, he'll have his associate's degree in August for guitar performance. Awesome.
Oh, wow.
And so.
I'm sure you're so proud.
I am so proud of him. So it actually turned out that sports were not his thing. Music is his thing.
And performing art in general, you know, writing.
Yeah,
and
he is definitely a performing arts guy. Yeah.
And what's so great, JB, is that, you know, you took a situation that obviously weighed so heavy on your family, and you found a way to bring a lot of light and to help him excel in a new way and to kind of pivot a little bit. Or a lot, and help him so much. And he's so lucky to have you.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. Wish we could go back and tell all the people that felt that he was not lucky to have me that.
It's so unfortunate and so, so sad. I mean, even with a positive test result, I mean, there's people in our community that haven't gotten a positive test result, but have been told, yes, for sure, you have mitochondrial disease. But you, your family does have this positive test result. I just, it makes me furious.
We've since gotten another test result in that shows that we have a defect in our chat gene. And that has been a little bit more solid than, because the muscle biopsy is outdated and longer. The gold standard. And so this new mutation with this chat gene has been a little bit more, I think, accepted from professionals. Mm-hmm. And it actually came with...
But at that time...
Yeah, we didn't have it until 2015.
Right. And at the time that all of this was happening, that was the gold standard, right?
Yeah, it was the gold standard. Yeah. It really should have been accepted back then. And I just couldn't believe that they weren't. So... but it happened. It happened with, you know, a couple of schools. But I think that one of the things you were going to ask me about, and I know we have like 3 minutes left, is what I did. And one of the things we did was that we up and moved 3 hours away to get closer to our doctors who did understand, and to a community that did have mitochondrial disease awareness. And that made a big difference for us. The boys were able to actually go to school, and the school actually understood their disease and didn't try to kill them. So that was really awesome. And instead of them coming home completely fatigued and, you know, trying to hurt us, they would come home and, you know, take a nap and get up and do their thing. Jonah was a little different for a while there, but, you know, overall, it was the best thing we could have ever done for our family, and I don't regret it at all. And I know that not every family can afford to just up and move their family, but if you're in a rural area where there is no awareness of mitochondrial disease, and you have a complicated case, or you have a situation where people are not believing you, I think that one of the best things you could do for your family, if you can make it work, and goodness knows we couldn't really afford it ourselves back then, is to just go somewhere where they get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hopefully today, though, there are more areas geographically speaking, where they do get it. You know, a lot has happened in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years.
Yes.
But it's just so sad that that's what had to happen. But I also give you so much credit for doing what your family needed, you know?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It was not easy.
No, this journey is not easy. Thank you so much for being on our podcast. Thank you for sharing your story and for really kind of taking us through some really dark times in your family. But I'm glad that there's also been some light. And please tell everyone the title of the book and how they can find it. And we'll also have it in the show notes.
Okay. It's called Sports Impossible. It's actually written under J.P. McGee and Noah Pilati, and like P as in Paul, and it's available on Amazon.
Awesome. Great. Well, we will make sure to link to it in the show notes. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
And hopefully we can connect again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.